Okay, so I try to have this talk very informal. So if you have questions, just ask. It's going to be about MHD wave turbulence, about MHD waves which interact weakly with each other. So MHD is very different from hydrodynamics because in hydrodynamics you don't have waves, right? You don't have bulk waves. So in MHD, when you have a fluid which is conducting, it becomes transparent to many modes, and we can ask how those modes interact with each other if the amplitudes are not infinitely small. So I will start with the equations. So we assume that we have a conducting fluid and there is some imposed magnetic field. This fluid, say, in the direction. I will assume the magnetic field is in the direction. And the equations are Navier-Stokes equation with a Lorentz force. And the equation for the magnetic field, the induction equation. So here, I already assume that fluid is incompressible. So let's assume that fluid is incompressible. So why we're making such an assumption? Well, it's just mainly for simplicity. Because weak turbulence is typically considered as a test bed for ideas in MHD, for general ideas in MHD turbulence. And of course, most important case is strong turbulence, which is common in nature. And in strong turbulence, one can show that at small scales, fluctuations of the density field are passively directed by the fluctuations, by Alvenic fluctuations. So if they're not present at the larger scales, if you don't generate large density perturbations at large scales, you won't get large density perturbations in the inertial interval of turbulence. So in this case, we start considering weak turbulence, assuming that density fluctuations are absent, that it's incompressible.
So Mach number is small in your considerations?
So it doesn't matter. So if you have strong turbulence, and strong turbulence is critically balanced at small scales, so fluctuations of magnetic field are much smaller than B naught, and parallel wave number is much smaller than the perpendicular wave number. One can show that in this case, density fluctuations decouple; they evolve independently of those Alvenic fluctuations, which are mostly incompressible, which are essentially incompressible. So, for example, in the solar wind, density fluctuations energy, which is contained in density fluctuations, is about 10% of the total energy. So they're not essential. But of course, if you generate large density fluctuations at large scales, then of course you will have to deal with, you know, fully compressible case. So then we assume that we consider weak turbulence, which is also incompressible. If you want to see what happens, if you also include take into account density fluctuations, Alvenic modes, slow modes, and fast modes, then this paper describes interaction of all these three types of modes in the weak turbulence regime. So I will explain a little bit later the criterion for weak MHD turbulence. But roughly, this is the case when you have turbulence which is dominated by waves. So you have a bunch of waves which interact only weakly with each other. So each wave survives, each wave packet survives very many independent interactions with other wave packets before its shape gets changed significantly, before it gets destructed. So then, as I said, we can always assume that there is a large-scale magnetic field. So B is equal to B naught plus B plus small fluctuation. Large-scale magnetic field will be responsible. So when the fluctuations are small, we will essentially have waves which are propagating along the background magnetic field. So I would like to separate this large-scale magnetic field and treat small fluctuations. So B is going to be small fluctuation, and V is going to be small fluctuation. So B is much smaller than V naught. So typical. And V is going to be also much smaller than B naught if you use Alvenic variables, B naught square root of 4 pi. So we assume that all fluctuations are small. Okay. Then it's convenient to, instead of using V and B variables, it is convenient to introduce the so-called Elsasser fields, linear combinations of V and B. So we're doing it just for simplicity, just to understand the structure of MHD equations better. So I use Z plus minus, which is V plus minus B normalized for pi.
Do you have any suggestions about magnetic particle number?
So here eta and nu are arbitrary in this case, because we're mostly going to be interested in the inertial interval of turbulence. So it's an interval of scales where dissipation is negligible. So scales are going to be much larger than the resistive scale and the viscous scale, right? So we just neglect those scales. But of course, if you want to understand what happens in the dissipation region, then it becomes important. So it becomes important which scale you need first. Then cascade goes to smaller scales, whether you hit diffusive scale or viscous scale first. But we would like to stay at scales much larger than the dissipation scales. Okay, then the equation for the Z plus and minus, the equations become very simple. So let me here neglect viscosity and resistivity, because those terms they're also simple, but we just don't need them. So and I neglected viscous and resistive terms. So these two equations for Z plus and Z minus are equivalent to those two equations if we neglect viscosity and resistivity. Right? So so what's interesting about this system of equation is that if we neglect the nonlinear term, the solution is just linear waves which propagate along the background magnetic field. So VLVN is, let me introduce VLVN here. So which just propagate up and down along the background magnetic field, if we neglect this nonlinear term. So the exact solution would be for Z plus or Z minus, would be just an arbitrary function of X plus or minus V. So function of any shape will propagate up or down along this background magnetic field, if we neglect the nonlinear term. Right. So, for example, if you would like to have a solution which propagates up, for example, then you can have that Z plus, for example, Z plus is, say, identically zero, but Z minus is non-zero, but is equal to F minus X minus V of T. So this solution will propagate along the background magnetic field in the positive direction. And for this solution, since Z plus is zero, V is going to be exactly equal to minus B everywhere. Identically equal to minus B everywhere. So it means that this wave packet can be quite complicated. So structure of V can be quite complicated. But if at each point V is equal to minus B, then such a structure will propagate along the background magnetic field up. But if V is equal to plus B everywhere, something's not working. So in the opposite case, if V is equal to plus B, such a structure will propagate down along the background magnetic field. So if we have, for example, when is this nonlinear structure become important? Because, for example, if Z minus is identically zero, then this term is zero, and there is only Z plus which propagates down. When Z plus is zero, there is only nonlinear term is again zero, there is only equation for Z minus which propagates down. Well, the nonlinear interaction becomes important when Z plus and Z minus, when these two wave packets overlap. So if you have, say, background magnetic field, this is B naught, and one wave propagates down, and some other wave packet propagates up. So they propagate without changing their shape. When they overlap, you have nonlinear interaction. Then turbulence is called weak when this nonlinear interaction actually doesn't change the shapes of packets significantly during one interaction. But if when they overlap, the shapes change significantly, you have strong turbulence. So in some sense, weak turbulence is when this term is much larger than this one. So this term should be much larger than this one, then you have weak turbulence. So VLVN Z plus, for example, should be much larger than Z minus dot grad Z plus. And you can see that when amplitudes of waves are small, it's indeed the case. When Z is much smaller than VLVN, it's the case. Right. So now, let's consider this case when we have only waves. And let's now look at the polarization of those waves. Right? So suppose that we have a background magnetic field, say, in this direction, B naught, and say this is going to be Z direction, spurb direction. Say we have wave vector K, which is like that, right? Then, since fluid is incompressible, both Z plus and Z minus, ZK, VK, and VK should be normal to the background, normal to the wave vector, right? So you can have two cases. You can have the case when both V and B is equals B or minus B in this plane, say, have V and B. Or you can have the case where they're in the perpendicular plane. Look too much. So it's two independent polarizations, right? So this wave, whose polarization is in the plane of B and K, is called pseudo-LVN wave. And this wave is called Shi-LVN. So Shi-LVN wave is a wave where fluctuations of the magnetic field and velocity field are in the direction normal to the background magnetic field. So those modes are basically shuffling magnetic field lines. They don't stretch them. But pseudo-LVN modes actually stretch magnetic field lines in the vertical direction. So what's also interesting about this system, that the energy which is contained in Z plus waves and Z minus waves, those two energies are independently preserved. So one can show that there are two integrals of motion of the ideal system. E plus is equal to, say, Z plus squared dsvx, and E minus Z minus squared dsvx are independently preserved. So that's the integral of motion.
In this system, plasma beta is small or large?
So if you need formally the incompressible case, so plasma beta should be large, very large. Mm-hmm. Then you have incompressible case. So then energy in Z plus and Z minus, those two energies are independently preserved in this system. You just multiply by, say, the equation by Z plus, integrate, and this term will due to incompressibility, this term will disappear, and this term doesn't change the energy. So, okay. Then we're dealing with two types of waves, Shi-LVN waves and pseudo-LVN waves, right? And let's now understand how these waves actually interact with each other. So for that, all these waves, and pseudo-LVN waves and Shi-LVN waves, have the same dispersion relation. Omega is equal to K parallel multiplied by VLVN. The dispersion relation holds for all of those modes, for Shi-LVN waves and pseudo-LVN. Shi-LVN modes and pseudo-LVN modes. So now let's try to understand how these modes interact with each other, right? Because we want to build theory of weak turbulence. So for that, as Colin told us 2 days ago, so we need to consider conditions for the frequencies and for the wave number. So suppose if we have three wave interaction, and in this case we have three wave interactions because nonlinearity one can see that three wave interactions dominate. So if for example one wave decays in two other waves, say. Then the frequencies should match, so omega of k, omega 1 of k1, just omega of k1, plus omega of k2, and wave numbers should match. So those two conditions are the conservation of energy and momentum when you have decay of one wave into two other waves, right? Now let's see whether this is possible or not. Whether with this dispersion relation we can satisfy both conditions. right? So, but here there is a trick. So there is some problem with the description because not with position, but there is some problem with application of this equation because look, Z plus interacts only with Z minus, and Z minus interacts only with Z plus. Z plus does not interact with Z plus, and Z minus does not interact with Z minus. So meaning that waves moving in the positive direction interact only with the waves moving in the negative direction, and vice versa. So they don't interact with themselves. Therefore, when we consider this relation, we have to postulate, we have to consider only the cases where say K1 parallel is positive and K2 parallel then should be negative. They should have different signs. This is a condition for this equation. So we should not look for solutions when those two modes have the same, those two numbers, those two cases are the same. They should have opposite sign. Then one can substitute this relation here and try to solve this equation. And you would see that the solution is possible only whether either K1 parallel is equal to 0 or K2 parallel is equal to 0. Otherwise, there is no solution. Just simply from this phase relation, from this relation of synchronization of three modes. Right? So what does this mean? It means that when these two modes interact with each other, let's say mode, say, suppose that K1 is equal to 0. Then when this mode K2 interacts with K1 and produces mode K, K parallel of this mode does not change. Only K parallel can change, but not K parallel. Right? So due to these interactions, parallel numbers of modes do not change. Only perpendicular numbers change. So if I schematically show the, where energy is contained in K space, so there is K perp and K parallel, say, right, display. Where is the energy? Suppose I'm supplying energy somewhere here. So in this region. So I'm supplying a lot of waves, a lot of K parallel, different K parallel, right? What would happen to this energy when waves start to interact? Well, the energy will just spread to positive K, to large K perp. But it won't spread in the vertical direction, along K parallel. Because all each of those modes here will interact with the mode, will scatter out of mode with very small K parallel and propagate to the right. So those modes here scatter all the other modes. Yeah?
Is there some simple physical picture that we can see this kind of line? Are we just thinking about charges moving along a few lines? Or?
It's an interesting question. So I say it just from this phase condition, so I don't really know if any hand waving picture why this happened. But possibly there is an explanation, but it's just. Yeah, so. Right, so it's just, so they just propagate to the right like that without changing its shape. That's what we would expect simply from these conditions of phase, of frequencies and wave number matching. Now, if this is so, then it means that when we initially, say, populate, or say, if we supply energy by external forcing at the scales, somewhere at large scales, right, energy will cascade due to this nonlinear interaction to larger and larger and larger K-prop. Without changing K parallel. So we will see modes, excited modes, will have very, very large K curve and small K parallel if we have large enough inertial interval. Right? So those modes will just move to the right, creating energy will populate modes with very large K curve and same K parallel. So K parallel won't change. Until, of course, it hits some dissipation here. OK, so if this is so, then in this picture, we see that eventually we will have modes whose fluctuations are, of course, perpendicular to B, and modes whose fluctuations are almost along the background magnetic field. Now let's try to figure out how those modes interact with each other. So let us look at this nonlinear term and say what happens is if, say, two modes are Shealvian modes, or one of them is Pseudalvian mode, or two Pseudalvian, just see how they interact with each other. Well, let's consider, for example, Shealvian mode. So let's consider, say, the equation for the Shealvian mode. So it has this term, Shealvian mode interacting with the Shealvian mode, right? And it will also have term where there is a Pseudalvian mode affecting Shealvian mode. But the Pseudalvian mode has a polarization which is along the background magnetic field. Shealvian mode has a polarization which is normal to the background magnetic field. Therefore, in this term, I have to put perpendicular gradient, and in this term, parallel gradient. Right? But perpendicular gradient is much larger than the parallel one. Then the first term dominates. That's why it is said that when you have weak turbulence, weak energy turbulence, and in the inertial interval, meaning very far from the region of forcing, it's all dominated by shear Algin modes, not by pseudo Algin modes. Pseudo Algin modes do not react back on the shear Algin ones, but they are passively advected by shear Algin modes. Now, if I consider, if I, for example, compare the terms pseudo and shear. So this would be the equation for pseudo-Algin modes. Then I see that this term picks up the perpendicular gradient, and this term picks up the parallel gradient. So this term dominates. Meaning that in the equation for the shear-Algin modes, it's this term dominates, interaction of shear-Algin modes among themselves. Pseudo-Algin modes just don't contribute. In the equation for the pseudo-Algin modes, it's again, they are passively advected by the shear-Algin modes, but they, you know, interaction among themselves is not important. So it's another simplification, right? So now out of these two classes of waves, shear-Algin modes and pseudo-Algin modes, we see that only one is important, shear-Algin modes. In the limit, and also, this is the first lesson, and second lesson, then, that this turbulence becomes very oblique. So in the inertial interval, K is almost normal to the background magnetic field. Well, if this is so, then we can do the following thing. We can just take those equations and say, in those equations, we don't care about fluctuations which are parallel to the background magnetic field. We should only care about fluctuations which are normal to the background magnetic field, about shear-Algin modes, right? Therefore, I can take this equation and just replace all the z by z perp. I'm doing here just suggesting. Right? So instead of full MHD equation, I consider this equation. And this is what is called reduced MHD equation. This is reduced MHD equation. So all those fields, Z perp, they have only two components, right, in the perpendicular direction. They're incompressible, have only two components. But they depend on all three special variables, X, Y, and Z. And moreover, this term is not negligible, this term which describes propagation along the in the third direction. It's actually dominant over this one. So those are essential, this is essential three-dimensional system. But the system describes the inertial interval of wave energy turbulence, of shear-Algin modes. If we solve the system and find those fluctuations z per plus, then we can substitute them into the equation for pseudo-Algin mode, which is adverted as a passive scalar. Right? So all the dynamics is described by this shear-Algin modes.
Yeah. What physical systems has this dominance of the shear-Algin modes seen?
So pretty much any strong energy turbulence is dominated by shear-Algin modes. So in solar wind, it's believed to be governed by solar by shear-Algin modes. In the interstellar medium, people also think that it's dominated by shear-Algin modes. So weak turbulence theory is a little bit tricky, but there was a paper by have some reference here, some by Sur, Bouquet, and other people in 2002, where they say that magnetosphere of Jupiter also has this Algin modes, which are in weak turbulent regime. So,
have the space probes seen that, or is there direct evidence?
So yeah. It's some direct measurement. Yeah.
And how about tokamaks?
So in tokamaks, the situation is a little bit more difficult because those fluctuations are mostly electrostatic, and here we're talking about essentially electromagnetic fluctuations. Okay, so now we can study just this equation, right? And it's easy to study it because there are two components to the perp, right? And there is incompressibility condition, so basically everything can be reduced to just simple scalar equation here. Okay. So. Now we don't need this. So now we can expand those fields, write everything in Fourier space. So with u of x, say z plus or z minus, write them together, is equal to a k plus or minus k x minus omega a k. So those are just the modes, these three k, where omega. So here omega is just k by Liouville. And if you need z plus, if I need z plus and z minus, so for z plus is going to be plus here, for z minus is going to be minus. Plus and minus here. Yeah. Then one could just take this z, substitute in this equation, and write the equation for the Fourier components, dA dt plus or minus. And I will write in this index notation, so k equals to minus ikn. I will explain in a moment what this p means.
So you also have to twice curl.
I will explain in a moment what this p means. It will be a projection operator, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, there is no. Okay, so this is the equation, and basically to remove pressure in Fourier space, you just need to project pressure to the direction normal to the direction of the wave number. So in this projection operator, PJN is just precisely that. Okay, so this is the equation which also Colin mentioned last time. So this is the wave can start, and So you assume that amplitudes of those modes A are small, so you can solve it and iterate this equation. We will finish it in statistical quantities, say spectra of turbulence. So for example, we can introduce second order correlation functions A plus minus K A plus minus K K prime, which is say energy plus minus of k plus k prime. So we have average over statistical ensemble. So we can assume that a plus dotted with a minus is zero. So assumption.
Yeah,
you can do that, but to get the energy, you need basically you need this term.
And you did this in a steady state, yeah?
No, not yet. So
not yet.
One can put, yeah, you're right, this should be time as well. Right.
What does this assumption mean?
So assumption means that the waves which move in the opposite direction are uncorrelated. So you have, say, you can supply waves in one direction and independently supply waves in the opposite direction, and then correlate it. So I will get back to this assumption if time permits. But for now, let's assume that. Now one can try to derive the equation for this correlation function. So how do you do that? You just multiply this equation with, say, equation for a plus, multiply by a plus, and average, right? So one gets something like time derivative of say a plus, which is going to be which is just the derivative of this energy, and here you will have the integral of the correlation function of three fields. So you can I will just write it schematically. So it's going to be A, say, minus, A, say, A plus, A minus, A plus. Right? So doesn't help because we have regression function of two variables, express regression function of three variables. So if we assume initially, say that initially when the interaction is, say, not turned on yet, those fields are uncorrelated, we will get zero. Right? Then we need to know this correlation function a little bit more precise to understand how second order correlation function evolves. Well, let's write the equation for the correlation function of three fields. So we just take this equation, we just take this product of three fields, differentiate over time, using this equation for each of those fields, right? And get the correlation function of four fields on the right-hand side. So actually, we can differentiate each of them and we get different correlation functions, say A minus, A plus, A minus, A plus, and it occurs three of them. So A plus, A minus, A minus, A plus. So, but if I correlate A minus, I get A minus, let me just write it. So A minus, A plus, A plus, A plus. Which one? Now we can say, okay, now let's assume that those fluctuations have random phases and split those correlation functions and see what happens. Split them in pairwise correlation functions, right? So here we can pair this A minus with this A minus, this A plus with this A plus. So we have E minus multiplied by E plus. Here we get... So we assume, you can assume that Gaussian statistics, that there's some initial Gaussian statistics. You can assume that there are random phases, so it's... But actually, it's nice assumption is necessary. So one can just show that if you look at long time behavior of this thing, then out of this four order correlation function, only second order cumulants will contribute in long time behavior, even if you start with just random arbitrary distribution of those fields. So here we compare this A minus and A plus, but here we have three A pluses and one A minus, it's going to be zero. So we'll have two terms which contribute. Now what we have to do, we have to integrate this over time, say from minus infinity when interaction was absent to some time, substitute this integral here, and then we close the system through second order correlation functions. Right, so and all this can be found in this paper or this one. This paper was actually, it's a very nice, very short and easy paper which explains all this. In four pages it explains all the weak turbulence, all the imaginary weak turbulence. So, but then finally we will get the equation which I would like to write somewhere here. It's going to be an important equation. So, d over dt, e plus, k. So let's, for example, write this equation for e plus. We can write exactly the same equation for e minus if we interchange plus and minus. V equal to pi divided by V of n, k dotted with k2 prop squared, k prop crossed with k1 prop squared, and k prop squared, k1 squared, prop k2 prop squared, e minus of k2. E plus K1 minus E plus of K delta of K2 parallel delta of K minus K1 minus K2 So this is the equation which we get, and if you need to write the equation for the minus, one needs just to flip all the signs here, plus. So what does this equation tell us? Just look at the structure. So there are only two terms which survived on the right-hand side, right? When we split first order correlation in the second one. So those are these two terms, this one and this one. So two terms survived. Now, where does this pi come from? Well, it comes from the integration of the third order correlation function. So when you integrate the third order correlation function, you deal with integrals like e to the minus I x t integral, say, And when t becomes very large, say goes to infinity, so let me just write it. 1 minus e to the minus ix t divided by ix. So and when t goes to infinity, it goes to the pi delta function of x plus I principal value of 1 divided by x. So this pi comes from this delta function when you do this integral. And x here, x2k parallel VLVL. So it happens that x is equal to parallel. And that's how delta of k parallel appears here. So this delta of k parallel and this pi come from this integral. And this VLVN in the denominator is just okay, take it out of the delta function.
So now, are you making a steady state assumption?
No, not yet, because it depends on time. Right? So you can just stick any distribution of waves and see how it evolves in this equation. There are no assumptions about steady state.
And what about realizability?
So there's a question about convergence of these integrals. I don't know what you mean by realizability here. So it's all realizable. This is
the energy yeah. is positive.
Yeah. So in fact, I can show that energy of E plus and E minus is actually conserved and positive. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So. okay. So. Yeah, but there's also a separate issue of convergence. So one needs to make sure that whatever steady state solutions we find, this integral should exist for these solutions. Right. Okay, so let's see what this equation tells us. So well, first of all, it tells us that look, there is a delta of k parallel. So k parallel should be zero, k2 parallel should be zero and should be here. So exactly what we discussed before. So E plus modes are scattered by E minus whose K parallel is zero. What we discussed before just from this phase, you know, of frequencies and wave vectors. So and E minus are scattered by E plus modes whose wave number is parallel number is zero. Also, it shows that this coefficient is scale invariant. So there is certain scaling to this coefficient. So one can look for the solutions in terms of power laws. And now we can ask, okay, what steady state solutions this equation has, right? So in principle, this equation can be solved numerically. One can add forcing at large, at small k, one can add dissipation and try to solve it numerically. So see how the spectrum evolves and you know, how we get to the steady state. Okay, so let's consider the simplest case when E plus is equal to E minus. In this case, it's called, so as we discussed before, energies in E plus, in Z plus and Z minus are independent. So those are independently conserved. So when E plus is equal to E minus, such a turbulence is called balanced. So same energies go in both directions. When, say, E plus is much larger than E minus, it's called imbalanced. So in nature, most probably the most common case are imbalanced turbulence, because you basically drive turbulence by some special localized sources, like say, the solar wind. So more modes go in one direction than in the opposite direction. But let's consider for simplicity the balanced case, right? So that E plus is equal to E minus. Then one can show that this equation has an exact solution. There is exact steady state solution for this equation when dE dt is equal to zero, meaning that this integral should be zero. There is a solution, so E plus. Now we just E plus is equal to E minus is equal to E. It's just some arbitrary function of KZ, K parallel, multiplied by K perp to the power minus V. So why this function is arbitrary? Well, because basically here, because of the delta function, you can see that no matter what function you choose, it will just check that it's going to satisfy this equation. So that is why it's called that the spectrum of weak energy turbulence, which actually it's called k to the minus 2, because when you write the energy spectrum, you have to also compensate by customary to compensate by the phase volume element. So I write it like that: E plus or E of k is equal to f k parallel k perf to the minus 3, and you multiply by 2 pi k perf, which gets you something which is proportional to k perf to the minus 3. It's just phase volume element. So that to normalize this energy, you just integrate over modulus of k. So in this energy spectrum, it's anisotropic, also as we expected before. So no matter what function of k parallel you have, all the energy will be, so no matter what initial distribution over k parallel you have, it will be preserved, but it will be just spread to large k curve without changing its parallel shape. So in some sense, this equation is just mathematical formulation of what we discussed before. It just gives you, exact, just some, analytic expression of what we discussed before.
Who obtained this spectrum, the first?
So, the first, I think several people, I think it just was Ink and Bhattacharjee who did this, the first, this spectrum. And then there was Galtier, Nazarin, Camille Pouquet in 2000, mm-hmm. and Bhattacharjee did it in, I think, 1996.
I don't understand this k2 power equals 0 because in principle they mean that this is not an eigenvalue.
I will get to that. So, but let me first explain how this result can also be derived from just some dimensional arguments. This k to the minus. And by the way, one could do numerical simulations and see the spectral numerical simulations. One could do numerical simulation of this system of this reduced MHD, drive it with broad spectrum of force in k parallel, and see what spectrum you get k to the minus 2. Okay, now let me just show some simple explanation of this spectrum so that one doesn't need to write this, solve this equation to get the spectrum. So as we said before, so in a weak Hellenic turbulence, there are wave modes moving in the opposite directions, and when they interact, the shape change slightly. They nonlinear interact only when they overlap, right? So let's assume that we have a wave packet whose length in this direction, say, L, and similar wave packets of similar scales. And we already know that spectrum becomes anisotropic, meaning that those wave packets are also anisotropic. So they are broader in parallel direction, shorter in perpendicular direction, because k perp is much larger than k parallel. And let's assume that this scale is lambda, which is smaller than L, possibly, right? And they interact with each other. So they interact only when they pass each other, when they overlap. So during one interaction, let's see how much you can distort, say this is z minus and this is z plus. So let's see how much you can distort z plus during one interaction. Well, from the MHD equation, delta z plus can be on the order of, so the nonlinear term is z minus dot grad z plus grad z minus is in perpendicular direction, so we'll pick up perpendicular gradient, z plus, this is a nonlinear term, which has to be multiplied by the interaction time, which is L divided by VLDN. Just passing time, crossing time, right? This is just distortion during one interaction. Now, how many interactions one needs to get to distort this wave packet significantly by order of magnitude? Well, it propagates down and interacts randomly with all those z minus which are uncorrelated. Right, so it can, you can increase z plus, you can decrease z plus, it's just kind of random change of its amplitude. So then one can see that number of interactions should be z plus, delta z plus squared. This is the number of interactions which is required. It's like a Brownian motion, right? This interactions can end up with z plus or minus. So now to destroy this wave packet, meaning to change its amplitude and its shape significantly, you have to accumulate n interactions, right? So what time does it require? Well, one interaction has a time L divided by VLVN, so total time before you destroy this wave packet will be n multiplied by L divided by VLVN. Let me substitute all those parameters here. And I get lambda squared VLVN. L z squared, z minus squared. This is total interaction time. So this is total time before this wave packet gets destroyed.
Lambda is a wavelength?
lambda is suppose that I have some wave packet.
Okay.
Right? So this is typical size of this wave packet in the perpendicular direction. And this is, and L is typical size in the parallel direction. So I consider a wave packet, not just one mode. Right? Okay, now this is a time when this wave gets destroyed, this wave packet destroys completely. So this is a time of energy cascade. So that's how you redistribute the energy from large scale to say scale, say, which is twice as small. Therefore, energy flux, say epsilon plus, is going to be z plus squared divided by tau. And it should be constant. Because each energy is conserved independently, it cascades independently to small scales. Now, if I substitute everything here, so one gets that z plus, and if we assume that z plus is on the order of z minus, everything is balanced, then it will give us z is on the order of lambda to 1/2, dLvn to 1/2, L to 1/4. And from there, z squared scales as lambda, meaning that the energy spectrum is going to be Fourier transform of z, so we have to get Fourier transform, so we get extra lambda, so it's going to be zk squared and scales, no, this energy spectrum zek scales as k to the minus 2, k first to the minus 2, because lambda stands for the perpendicular direction. So this is just some simple derivation, simple hand waving. Simple dimensional derivation of the spectrum. Yeah.
But here you have an explicit dependency on L.
Yeah. Which assumes that it doesn't change because, as we said before, that when you have cascade, that nothing changes in the parallel direction. So we assume that L is constant. L doesn't change. But only the packet gets distracted in the perpendicular direction.
But you conclude from this scaling algebra. And if you say that epsilon is constant, then you get a spectrum of L. When you get something out of L, so you get a spectrum in K.
Right. But also, let me assume, I said it's just, this argument does not allow you to do this, to derive it vigorously, but assume that L is constant. I'm assuming that it's constant. Okay. And I'm taking Fourier transform of the Z in the field perpendicular direction. So that's what I get. Yeah. Okay, but then, let's go to the more recent stuff to actually whether it's indeed the case. So, for example, you can have like whether the theory is actually self-consistent. Whether there are any problems with the theory. And as Geoffroy said, there is a problem with the theory, because if you look at this expression here and at this interval here, right? What does it say? It says that all those modes are scattered of the fluctuations with k parallel equals zero, right? But if we try to ask how those fluctuations evolve k parallel equals zero, we have to look at this equation again. And set k parallel equal to zero in this equation, which will give us that we can estimate this integral as, say, f square not k perp to the minus 2 divided by dLvn. This is how this integral would scale if you substitute the scalings of this, if you substitute that E is f of k parallel multiplied by k, so and consider it's k parallel equals zero. So this is when k parallel goes to zero, this is non-zero; it's a finite number. But the linear frequency of those modes goes to zero, so we get into contradiction with the original assumption that this equation describes the mode whose linear frequency is much larger than the nonlinear frequency of nonlinear interaction, right? So this equation itself tells us that when we go to k parallel equals to zero, this number remains constant, remains finite, but the frequency of the linear modes become very small. So how this problem was circumvented in Gaultier et al. Paper? They say, okay, well, this equation, you probably cannot go to k parallel zero, so if this is k parallel and this is your function f of k parallel, you go up to some k which is not close to zero. But then they assumed, just by assumption, that this function continues smoothly to zero. Just assume that the value of this function is zero, it's the same as here. And everything is fine, if you assume that. And then if you look at this equation and ask whether this equation would develop any singularity if it evolves, it doesn't look like it develops any singularity. It just evolves keeping this function smooth. Because the integral equation actually moves this function, makes this function smoother rather than. right? So, but then where problems come. Now I'm going to argue that in fact this function is not smooth at KPRL zero. And how this appears is a very interesting question. So the matter is the following. So when we derive those equations for a plus and a minus, we assumed that the correlation function of z plus a plus and a minus, z plus and z minus is zero, identically zero. Which is made by assumption, right? And what does this function mean? So this function is actually z is it's v squared minus b squared. Right? And for the Alvian waves, as we discussed before, v is equal to plus or minus b. So this should be zero for Alvian waves. Except for the problem that when frequency goes to zero, we don't have Alvian waves. Fluctuations are not Alvian waves. So when frequency goes to zero, there is no such relation between v and b, which follows from the linearized equation. Right? So when frequency goes to zero, it's not necessary that this function be zero. Well, then what one can do, one can just write the equation for this function. Just don't assume anything, but just write the equation exactly in the same way as we wrote the equation for epsilon plus and epsilon minus. Just dot a plus with a minus, average, and do all this machinery of weak turbulence. One can assume that initially, this integral is zero. Only e plus and e minus are non-zero. And see what happens. Suppose that initially it's zero, there is only e plus and e minus. So when we split for further correlation, we assume that all those correlation functions are zero. Just see whether they're going to be generated or not if they're initially zero. It turns out that this correlation function is always generated by interaction of z plus and z minus. So this assumption that this function is zero is inconsistent. It's always generated. And if we, again, draw the spectrum of turbulence, k perfect and k parallel, so suppose that we solve this equation, we found the spectrum which where energy propagates along k perfect in this direction, right? Then what happens that this function is generated in a very small region around k parallel, where this term, this nonlinear interaction, is comparable to the linear interaction. So in this cone, and I would like to stress that there are infinitely many waves. So I'm considered kind of continuous regime. So there are infinitely many wave numbers. So I'm not saying that we just have dealing with one mode, right? So in this cone, which I have it here. Yeah, so where k parallel is smaller than f naught delta b over b squared k perfect. So there is a cone indeed. Those are quantities at the scale, at the driving scale. And so in this cone, this correlation function grows inside this cone. Now, what is this correlation function? It has a special name. It's the residual energy of Meissner turbulence. It's called residual energy. Moreover, one can show that this term, this integral, which includes e plus and e minus, which generates residual energy, is always negative. So it's always negative. For any spectrum you substitute here, not even power law, it's always negative. Not even this knows minus 3 or whatever. It's always negative. Now, it just grows. One can just show that it just grows. At some point it becomes large, and then in the equation for the residual energy, so you have to include the terms. So if I call it E naught, then the equation for E naught will give me D naught over dt. I call it E naught. We'll have the integral which includes E plus and E minus, which will just generate this residual energy. But when it becomes very large, I have to introduce terms determining how it interacts with E plus and E minus. Then we'll stop the growth. It will saturate, and you will see that so at some point it saturates, and it grows only in this small region, and then when it becomes large enough, it starts to react back on e plus and e minus. Because in this equation, I have to include terms which include residual energy, and then it starts to grow also this singularity in those spectra of e plus and e minus. Without that, we didn't see this numerical solution, we didn't see singularity in this equation. But with this residual energy, you see. Okay, now what happens next? If this cone grows, what happens next? So, well, it will grow until it hits the width of the weak turbulence spectrum itself, right? And in this case, turbulence becomes strong. You're not dealing with weak turbulence, you're dealing with this. This is precisely the point where you have a transition from weak turbulence to strong turbulence. So it just happens to be this place where basically the region where nonlinearity is essential becomes just everywhere. It just covers the whole spectrum of your initial fluctuations. So it tells us very important thing that when you get to the region of strong turbulence here, in this region, you not only have strong interactions among those modes, but you also have a lot of residual energy here. So this is a cone. So in strong energy turbulence, indeed, people see numerical simulations in the solar wind observations that magnetic energy exceeds the kinetic energy, always. Even if you drive at large scales, you can drive Z plus and Z minus at large scales. So you drive V and B equally, with the same amplitudes. Say you can drive Z plus and Z minus at large scales. So you don't drive, say, B stronger than V or V stronger than B. Turbulence itself will create imbalance between V and B. And here turbulence becomes strong, and then a new story. So, and it's a completely new story. So spectrum is not, the energy doesn't flow along Cape Perp, so it starts to broaden after that, and it's a totally different story. Yeah, so I think that's it. That's why actually I wanted to stop, kind of show the boundary of this, where the theory breaks down. Yeah.
So spectrum, cracking the rotational spectrum or the dry spectrum, they correspond to the strong energy turbulence?
So let me just draw it what Colin also did last time. So if I draw the spectrum versus K-perp, P of K-perp. So suppose that you start with the weak turbulence regime. You will get energy spectrum in log scale, K-perp to the minus 2, right? After that, after you have transitioned to strong turbulence, the spectrum changes, it becomes shallow, and what we see in numerical simulations is very close to the minus half. So in one system, you see this transition. So weak turbulence approximation holds up to certain wave number. After that, it breaks down, and spectrum changes. Now, the question about Eroshnikov and Krechten. So when Eroshnikov and Krechten developed their theory, all their discussion is about weak turbulence, about this region. If you just see the papers, they always say about wave packets, many interactions, how many interactions you need to get to distort the wave packet. But they did not consider this anisotropy, that actually all the energy cascades in one direction. So what Geoffroy mentioned, so they considered the case when you get Z lambda to 1/2, L to 1/4, VLVM, something 1/4. They assume that both scales are the same in their theory. If both scales are the same, it scales as lambda to 1/4. And you get spectrum minus 3/2 here. That's what Eroshnikov and Krechten spectrum. It's spectrum of weak turbulence when you have kind of spherical wave packets moving up and down and weakly interacting with each other. And if you assume that both scales change in the same way, you get minus 3/2. So their spectrum was minus 3/2, but it was a spectrum of weak turbulence, essentially weak turbulence. Goldrack and Richter did strong turbulence. It was different. So now, yeah, so and yeah, so that's the relation to the Eroshnikov and Krechten.
So this result that B squared is greater than B squared as you evolve the spectrum, is that shown from the full energy equations or from the reduced energy equations?
So when we simulate weak MHD turbulence, we need to go to reduced MHD equations because we want to get rid of this Pseudo-Alvian mode, because we want to force broadly in K-perp, it still don't generate in K-parallel and don't generate Pseudo-Alvian mode. So, and you can see it in weak turbulence, in numerical simulations, you can just see it. In strong turbulence, even in full MHD, people also see exactly the same result. So B becomes larger than V along the inertial, it's slightly, so if you look at the spectra, they're slightly larger. They kind of, it looks like they're approaching each other, but there's always excess of B over B.
Thinking without a strong
So without a strong guide field, it's difficult to get into the inertial into the universal regime, because when you get to smaller and smaller scales, fluctuations become smaller and smaller. But the large scale magnetic field, whatever field is created by large scale eddies, is still the same. So and universal regime starts, at least as shown in numerical simulation, it's shown in numerical simulations when delta B over B is about 1/3 or 1/5. Right? So if one doesn't impose any guide field and say that delta B scales a lambda to 1/3, so like let's say Kolmogorov, right? So to get to the scale where delta B lambda divided by delta B naught is about 1/5, one is to decrease lambda by 100, which is not doable in the simulation. So that's why one needs to impose some guide field, simply to get into the universal regime.
So on Tuesday,
Kolm
told us that the theory of weak children could be derived for dispersive waves. And here you're talking about MHD waves, Hansen waves, which are non-dispersive.
Right.
So why does it work in this case?
It's important. So it works because, of course, for non-dispersive waves, it's hard to derive this theory, because if you write the equation, those positive half waves are omega is equal to KS, for example, right? Some acoustic waves. Then the equation that omega 1 is equal to omega 2 plus omega 3 and omega is equal to omega 2 will hold only with this. We have k and k1 and k2, they're all in the same direction. Right? Meaning that these three waves will always travel together. They will never separate. They will interact as strong as you wish if you wait long enough. Right? But in MHD case, the situation is different. Those waves cannot go in the same direction, because nonlinear interaction couples the waves going in different directions, in the opposite directions. So this nonlinearity is quite, say, peculiar in this case. Z plus does not interact with Z plus. If it did, you would have a problem.
So in other words, is the singularity for K2 power equals 0 due precisely to the fact that the waves are non-dispersive?
Yeah.
You consider a specific case when the imposed magnetic field, you know, is much larger than all fluctuations.
Right.
In principle, so in such a case, you exclude completely small scale dynamo.
Right, because magnetic field is very strong.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's not amplified any longer, right? It's really dynamically important.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, but so if you have forcing in the system, so you have also dynamic fluctuations and waves,
right?
Then, this consideration is not
valid. So if you say start with very weak magnetic field, but you drive your system, right?
Yes, just then, like dynamo, large scale dynamo.
Yeah, then probably you will be always in the strong turbulence regime. Yeah, you won't get weak turbulence regime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's essential. So large scale magnetic field is necessary for the presence of weak turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And in the solar wind, these conditions is always satisfied, meaning that both field is much larger.
Yeah, fluctuations, I mean, depending on the scale, if you go down the scale, fluctuations become smaller and smaller. So in addition, there is a broad range of scales, maybe three orders of magnitude, where delta B is much smaller than B.
Mm-hmm.
And the spectrum which they observe is close to the spectrum of strong turbulence, not weak turbulence. So therefore, it's in a strong turbulence region. For strong turbulence, you can also have strong turbulence when delta B is much smaller than B, because basically the only thing you need to require for strong turbulence is that these two terms are on the same order. It's Bradley Phillips condition, what Colin told us. So these two terms are on the same order. It's called critical balance when you have strong turbulence. But for that, it's perfectly fine to have Z much smaller than VLVN, because this picks up parallel gradient, it becomes perpendicular gradient. But if you have strong anisotropy, this is much smaller than this, but this much smaller than this. So it's, they can balance.
In this transition to strong turbulence, which is the more important approximation that you made, the factorization of the fourth moments into products of second moments, or the reduced MHD equation?
So you can do full MHD equation and get exactly the same result, so exactly the same strong turbulent regime. So it's not essential. So reduced MHD is so computationally, it's just cheaper to do the simulations than to simulate full MHD, if you want just some practical advance. Right, but in strong MHD, you cannot, of course, you can do this only as a closure, but there is no reason why you should split those cavities, just as a closure, which is also going to be realizable, by the way. It's like EDQ in M.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.